Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we ask brilliant educators everything you've ever wondered about teaching English language learners. I'm your host, Liesl Koop. I'm an ENL teacher and resource specialist with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, listeners, welcome back for another episode of Our Burning Questions. I'm, as always, honored to get to have this conversation on behalf of all the teachers that we serve. And today we have very important Our Burning Questions. Our questions for this episode are, how can shadowing English language learner students be a catalyst for change? And why is conversational discourse important for L students at the high school level? So today we're talking in particular about students at the high school level, and there will be another episode that focuses also on conversations at the elementary level. So today our guest who is going to respond to all of our burning questions is an author, a teacher, and I'm going to let her introduce herself and talk about what she does, Dr. Ivania Soto Hinman. Welcome, Dr. Soto.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.
We're so glad to have you.
Thank you. And I hope everybody out there is safe and well. I know it's a difficult time, but our resiliency will get us through this. I'm always so impressed with teachers and what we're, you know, capable of doing. And I think this time will bring forth additional innovations in the classroom. So I am, my name is Ivania Soto. I teach at Whittier College. I'm a professor at Whittier College. I train pre-service teachers primarily in second language acquisition. I also teach an urban education class and research methods there. And Whittier College is a small liberal arts college. It's where, for better or for worse, Richard Nixon graduated.
Claim to fame.
Yeah, that's our one claim to fame, yes.
Great. And what are you did say, you know, you talked about language acquisition, teacher prep. Are there any other special areas of interest that you pursue?
So I've written a lot about academic discourse and the importance of it for English language learners, shadowing English learners as a way to remind us that we need to require English learners to speak in the classroom setting and so that they begin to meet their language proficiency expectations. And so that they have a voice and identity in the classroom setting. So all of those pieces sort of put together. More recently, I've been working for the last 2 years part-time on a grant with the California Association for Bilingual Education. Where we're training teachers who already have their bilingual authorizations but haven't taught in that setting for a while, because in California we have a predominantly English-only, right, policy. And that was lifted in 2016 with Proposition 58. So lots of exciting things happening around bilingual education in California as well. So more recently, moving and train on shadowing, actually, in that setting as well.
Cool. And what drew you to working with English learners?
I'm a former English language learner myself. So my first language was Spanish. I'm of Costa Rican descent. My mother's story is very much central to my own work and research. She immigrated to this country when she was 9, struggled to acquire English right at a level that should have been expected of her in elementary school. Eventually in high school, she enrolled herself, was her own advocate, and was able to become proficient in English. And then she made sure that she taught us Spanish at home, made sure that we also got the services that we needed in the classroom setting, my sister and I have an older sister. And so ours is a good story, a positive story. But some of those same inequities, right, continue to exist in classrooms and in systems. And so my work, in addition, I work with school districts, provide professional development around the books that I've written, and I try to disrupt the silence, if you will, in classrooms, or help teachers to disrupt silence in the classroom setting. So that's a bit of my story and my interest in this area.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing that. And I want to jump right in. I love that phrase, disrupting the silence. So I want to talk about L shadowing. So what is involved in the L shadowing protocol that you designed?
So what we do is we go into classrooms using a protocol that focuses in on speaking and listening, specifically academic speaking and academic listening. Those are the two most underdeveloped domains of language. Oftentimes what we see in teacher ed programs or in professional development is an emphasis on reading and writing instead of speaking and listening, right? And we know that speaking is a scaffold for writing, listening is a scaffold for reading. And so so what we do is we go into classrooms with that protocol, and we, at every 5-minute interval, we take down the activity that one English learner is engaged in. And each educator would have one English learner that they're focusing on. So we're stopping, right, our day with 180 students or 36 students, right? And we're just really focusing in on the experience or a day in the life of that English learner at every 5-minute interval. And then we code what they're doing specifically for academic speaking and academic listening. And we also take down qualitative data. So it's an ethnographic research method of the shadowing protocol. And it really helps just create an urgency for change on behalf of English learners. Most of the time when teachers shadow, what they find is what I'm seeing more recently. I've been doing this since 2003. So in 2003, we saw English learners speaking in the classroom setting less than 2% of their school day. So across a 6-hour school day, they would only be speaking, right, less than 2% of that time. I'm now seeing a bit of a move forward where with districts, even before I start working with them, typically if they've had some kind of foundational professional development like Kagan or anything, right, collaborative conversations, it's improved, and it's now at baseline 5 to 10% of an English learner's school day, right? What we want to do with shadowing is continue to monitor over several years. It's not just a one-shot deal to create that urgency for change. It should also be used for progress monitoring of how is our professional development around academic discourse, right, impacting student voice in the classroom setting and their academic oral language production.
I think that will be shocking to our listeners to hear those statistics and that data. I have had the opportunity to use your protocol when we've gone into districts and schools, and I think that there may be a lot of uncertainty about how to get L's speaking, or like, is there a right place to start or a right way to start? So we're going to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. In addition to the very small amount of time that you see students L speaking in the classroom, what else does the data gathered during shadowing tell us about our L's and how we support them?
Mm-hmm. So we start, what I ask districts to do, and this is all outlined, there's a book called ELL Shadowing is Catalyst for Change if you want to read more about it. But what we start off by doing is I ask district folks in the district office who are helping me organize the shadowing experience to put together an English learner profile. And the English learner profile will have data on, right, students' achievement. So their whatever content area assessment is being utilized, the state assessment, if you will. the language assessments that's being utilized, grades. And we look at 3 years unit assessments as well, because we want more kind of performance-based assessment. And we look at 3 years worth of data to take a look at, even before we go into the classroom, what are this student's strengths, right? And then what are their areas of need? And we want to start from an asset base, and so we start with their strengths. The achievement data and this analysis of the achievement data allows educators to become aware of their English learners and their specific performance over time. They tend to, oftentimes as educators, we get that one sheet of paper from the district or from the administrator or principal that has the English learners, you know, names on it, and maybe their levels, their proficiency levels, right? Language proficiency levels. But we don't get a clear picture of how are they doing in reading and in math and in, right, other content areas where they may be stronger. And so we take a look at this whole picture of their, right, achievement profile, if you will, to then triangulate the observational data. So the observational data through the protocol, the ELL shadowing protocol, really tells us the why of, right, the phenomenon that ends up being the achievement results. Our achievement results, our test results don't often, right, tell us a whole lot about what the student is experiencing in the classroom setting. And so we try to, in the debrief, after we've collected 2 hours worth of data with at every 5 minute interval, we then triangulate and go back to the profile and say, how are these two things linked, right? So for example, an English learner may be very strong in listening on their language proficiency assessment because that's what they're mostly being asked to do in the classroom setting, right? Mm-hmm. They're not being asked to speak, so perhaps their speaking score is quite low. Or we may not even have realized this is a brilliant English learner student in math, right? Or in another content area. Perhaps they're really creative, or, you know, whatever, their English language development course is quite strong. And so we try to take a look at, right, the aggregate data. So the aggregate being all of the students that were shadowed across, let's say, a school building or a grade level, whatever, you know, it may be. But we also really focus and zoom in on individual English learners' data. Hoping that, so what I'm trying to model through that process is that as teachers, we need to know more about our English learners and how they're achieving their strengths and then their areas of need.
As you were talking, I was thinking, you know, we have districts in our region who have thousands of English learners, and we also have districts who have two. Mm-hmm. So do you think that this is a process that a teacher could do on their own? Is there value in that, or is it something that needs to be done by a team of teachers in a building?
They can do it on their own. I think there's power, though, in systems, right? Systems thinking. Mm-hmm. And the title of the book is ELL Shadowing as a Catalyst for Change, and in particular, systemic change. Because if I'm doing all this great stuff on my own in my classroom, but down the hall, right, my English learner goes to several other teachers and is not receiving that support because they haven't had this experience, then, right, they're going to suffer. And all of it's all of our responsibility, right, across content areas to meet the needs of English learners. So I typically, with shadowing projects, encourage school districts, because I've had schools specifically ask me to come in and do projects. Oftentimes it's at the district or county office level. And I have them really think through who that first cohort of teachers might be, teachers who are, you know, really interested in English learners and improving their achievement, or teacher leaders alongside of other administrators. And then we continue with, you know, kind of cohort after cohort until everybody or close to everybody has gone through the process, a critical mass at least.
That seems like it could have a huge impact on even just the awareness that all teachers have about what L's experience in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So how is what we see during shadowing connected to larger topics like equity and the quality of educational experiences for L's? You have talked about this already a little bit, but can you expand on that? What is that lack of speaking or lack of opportunity to engage with peers have to do with equity and the kinds of experiences that our kids are getting?
Mm-hmm. With this process, we're really focusing in on linguistic equity or language equity, right? The person talking the most is the person who's learning the most. And, right, if the teacher is doing most of the talking, then they're getting a lot smarter, right? Or if certain students are doing most of the talking, our higher end students, then they're getting the most benefit, right, in terms of learning. And so we want to make, through this process, right, teachers aware and ourselves aware. This really happens at the individual level. It's right, I can do cartwheels or I can present all kinds of data. There's lots of things I can do, but what I have found creates the most impact on behalf of teachers is going into a classroom, taking a look at specifically one student, right? We're stopping everything just to look at that student's linguistic needs, so that we can create more equitable language and content and environments, right, for those students.
Great. Is there a way that teachers or school leaders can shadow students in the situations that we're in right now in this kind of crisis learning or, you know, remote distance learning situation?
Yes, I actually had to think through how to do that with my pre-service teachers this semester, because they had to stop their field work. They couldn't go back into schools to complete the hours that they needed to. Mm. And so there are a few ways. I'm also developing a virtual ELL shadowing professional development series where I'm training teachers virtually. To do this work. I'm using a series of videos. Actually, it's Jeff Swears from his website. He has several videos of students having collaborative conversations.
Yes.
And they're short videos.
Yeah.
And so to train teachers, and pre-service teachers, I'm having them go in and together we will watch a video for inter-rater reliability using the tool. We'll have the tool in front of us. We'll watch the video, because the videos are about 3 minutes, we'll monitor what happens at the beginning and at the very end of the video to kind of get down how to code, right, how to use the tool. Mm-hmm. And then there are my students, I think there are 9 videos on his website. We went through one together, and then there are 8 more. So then they complete the shadowing that way. Those videos are quite strong. That's not typically what we see in a classroom setting. So we had to sort of, you know, acknowledge that. And but for classroom teachers, they might be able to do this. Like a lot of what I'm doing right now through my online teaching at Whittier College is I use the breakout option a lot, where I'll have an open-ended question that's carefully planned, intentionally planned, and then I place my students into breakout rooms to have a conversation. And so what I can do then is monitor, use the shadowing protocol, right, when my English learner is in that breakout room. That's a little tricky too, because I like to monitor all of the breakout rooms. Mm-hmm. So you might sprinkle your English learners throughout different breakout rooms and then, you know, kind of get a sense of how a variety of English learners are doing.
Yeah.
Instead of just the one. And that's where you can pre-select, right, the breakout rooms and where English learners would go. Or you can set up a time where you have a few English learners that you're working with at a particular appointment time, Zoom appointment time, and have them work on a particular activity together that you have given some instructions around, where they feel comfortable kind of talking to each other about an activity, and then monitor, your English learner inside of that during that time. So there are a variety of ways that I'm playing with. And so I started today by saying, this is an opportunity for us to be innovative, as well. And that has really pushed me, kept going online, mostly just Zoom and Moodle at Whittier College, has pushed me and also inspired me to be more innovative and to approximate a lot of the collaborative structures that I use face-to-face in an online setting.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting and fascinating to see how people are figuring out how to do what they need to do. And I think it would be really a nice and powerful undertaking for schools to try to do this during this virtual learning, because I've heard actually some teachers in our region say that some of their L's are speaking more in their Zoom classrooms or their Google Meets than they have in the actual classroom, which I think is really interesting.
Yes. Yeah. So maybe it's less scary because it's not, there's, it's not face-to-face, if you will.
Right.
Yeah. No, I see that.
Where do you think there are opportunities for leveraging change when using shadowing as a tool to better know and support our L's?
So when we analyze the aggregate data, so let's say there's a group of 30 teachers who have shadowed, representing 30 different English learners within a building or a school site. We then have sort of trend data, at least, to take a look at what percentage of time our English learners are speaking, for that baseline piece. And it oftentimes really shocks people, to hear that even now, as I suggested in 2003, when I started doing this work, it was less than 2%. It's now 2020, and we're at 5 to 10% within most systems. And so when I say that, teachers are typically shocked, but when they experience it themselves and then are a part of that data collection and they are a part of the debrief and the data analysis portion of the shadowing experience, they begin to see and understand why we're asking them to make instructional changes on behalf of English learners. And if we have 30 teachers doing that at a time, it then begins, it's that critical mass, and we begin to create change, systemic change. The second half of the shadowing book is about what do you do after shadowing? Because shadowing is just the first part of it. The second part of the shadowing training, it's a 3-day series, so the last 2 days are all about academic oral language development strategies and having teachers really become proficient, and effective themselves around using these strategies, comfortable, if you will, around using these strategies. For most teachers, we tend to do what we've seen most and what we've seen last. And what we've seen most and last at the college level is teacher lecture, And so undoing that silence takes time and practice, and practicing disrupting silence by using specific strategies also takes time and practice and support. And so between each day, usually the 3-day shadowing series, there would be a month at least in between each day. We give teachers that whole month, to try on that strategy. And then we support them along the way. When they come back, we discuss and we reflect on how did that strategy go, Maybe it was, not very successful the first time. Let's take a look at why that was, and let's try to see what other kind of techniques we can use to begin to perfect, right, the mm-hmm. strategy. And so that level of support, I have found that teachers are really, they're open to.
Mm, that's helpful. And when I'm thinking about how I've read your work and used your work as a teacher and Dr. Zweer's work as well, the thing that strikes me about both of them is that they're so straightforward and that they have so much impact. Like, it seems like, oh yeah, like, why didn't I think about that? Once you like realize, okay, I can do this. So that's really helpful to me. And it's really, I think, something teachers are looking for, like, make it straightforward and make it applicable and make it something that I can use the next moment I'm in my classroom. And I really appreciate that about your work.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for trying it on.
Yeah. So let's talk about speaking. Let's get a little meta.
Yeah.
Our burning question of this episode is, why is conversational discourse important for AL students? So let's talk about some things around that. What role does speaking play in overall learning, and maybe not just for ALs, but for all learners?
Mm-hmm. So speaking, most of us make meaning through talk. And right. So again, going back to the quote, the person talking the most is the person who's learning the most. We can, and this is also kind of intertwined with listening and active listening. We can only listen for about adult learners or young adult learners, about 15 minutes, actively. Most of us we'll tend to check out after that. And so one of the things that I espouse and I use with teachers and with my pre-service teachers, and I try to practice what I preach as well, is that I won't talk for any more than 15 minutes before I have, participants or my students, interact with each other and make personal meaning in some way, whether that be a partner talk, a think, pair, share. In my book, I have a think, pair, share on steroids, which requires active listening and consensus making. Speaking ensures that students also are engaged, that they're motivated, that they have an academic identity in the classroom setting, that there's equity, right? It's foundational. It's the foundation of literacy for English learners. And it's also connected to writing, speaking and writing, right? So, speaking is a mental outline for the writing process. And if I'm paired, and this is, right, intentionally paired and carefully paired with somebody who is linguistically stronger than I am, then I'm going to be, that's a mental model, right? Or that's a mental outline, rather, or a model of sorts for me. In terms of the writing process.
So we know, based on the data that you and all the teachers who've used the L shadowing have gathered, that L's aren't really speaking that much. Why? Why aren't they speaking?
I think as teachers, we have good intentions. We tend to think, oh, I don't want to put the student on the spot. I don't want to make them uncomfortable. Sometimes we have the pobrecito syndrome, the poor thing, right? And right, instead, what we can do is require speaking on behalf of everybody, create comfortable environments for taking language risks, where we have a community of speaking, right, that is expected. And so oftentimes I find that, and I think we're getting better at this. I find that we're getting better as teachers systemically around this with the awareness levels and in a variety of ways. So I think sometimes we don't want students to be uncomfortable. We don't realize that if we put them in small groups, or if we pair them carefully and intentionally, that that's going to be a much more comfortable environment for speaking, right? And that they will take more language risks when they are in that safe setting. It's like a little family, right? A small group is like a family, and culture and language are intertwined, right? And many of our English learners come from more communal orientations. And so these smaller settings, right, will be more comfortable for them. And then what I like to do, I walk around, listen in on conversations, even with my college students, and I will ask them for permission. Would you be willing to share out now that you've had this practice round? I really like what you've said. It's going to take the conversation deeper. And then you ask them for permission, and now, right, we've had a practice round of speaking before we have a whole class discussion.
I like that idea of practicing before you have to perform, you know. What about home language? What if kids don't speak English yet? Do you think there's value in having kids speak in their home language, even if there's nobody else in the classroom who speaks that language?
Yes. Oh yeah. Whatever language that the student brings to the table, that's what we want to build upon, whether it be a primary language, whether it be a variation of English. And then slowly, right, we will have students translate that conversation, right? Using sentence frames and a word wall and, you know, a variety of scaffolds to get to English. But if all that students can produce is their primary language at the time, then we want to honor that. If they can produce a bit of the primary language and some perhaps non-academic English, then have them produce that, and then we will work on the academic language part and recasting, right, those responses in academic terms. But definitely the role of transfer, right, from the primary into the second language.
Right. Well, you've talked a little bit about systems change and systems thinking. So how is the broader system of education responsible for this kind of not speaking very much construct that we see kids operating within today?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I hearken back to, right, our teacher ed programs, and as I suggested, our college, our own experiences as students too, right? I mean, those of us who survived when, you know, or survived in the sense that we're college educated now and we made it, that sort of thing. It was because we were oftentimes able to actively listen and right, be successful due to that, or other patterns that, right, we used in schools. Are we presentable, right? All of those other characteristics that oftentimes counselors or teachers use. And okay, go back to your question. Sorry.
That's okay. I'm wondering, how is the system of education responsible for what we see now, where kids, and not just ELLs, but a lot of kids are just not speaking very much in class?
Okay. So, yeah. So in, we tend to do, again, what we have seen last and what we've seen most. In teacher education programs, you oftentimes don't see a lesson plan that has speaking and listening required or planned for. I do in mine. I created one where my students, they're actually right now creating their SADAI lessons, which are their final, and they have to, they usually micro teach in class, but now they have to video themselves with at least one particular scaffold at a particular perfect language proficiency level. But so in pre-service, right, we need to teach our future teachers to plan for speaking and listening, which are the most underdeveloped domains of language. There's also a whole bunch around, right, as teachers, we want to be in control. We want to be comfortable, right? Yes. This whole Zoom thing is turning everything upside down, because now we have to learn all of these new methods of of teaching online. But so being, you know, comfortable with the noise level, something as simple as that there's, as long as it's good talk, you know, as long as it's students are on topic and we're monitoring that, we're walking around and listening in, structures are in place, there are frames. So all of those pieces sort of have to be in place. But as teachers, we might not have had models of that, strong models of that. And I find even we haven't had a lot of professional development in this area specifically. And not sustained professional development either, right? We might have had drive-by professional development or a one day, you know, and that's going to solve everything.
Right.
This takes time. I usually work with school districts over at least 2 or 3 years, right? Mm-hmm. Around, we have follow after the 3 day shadowing series the first year, I then come in the next year and we have at least 2 days where we work on additional academic or conversational discourse strategies. If there isn't that reminder or accountability, I find that we tend to forget, right? It's not at the forefront.
I hear a lot of teachers say, you know, teachers of English language learners and teachers who do not have training teaching English language learners, I hear them say, I don't know how to get my students speaking because they're new to learning English and I don't speak their home language, or nobody in our class or our school speaks their home language. What kinds of activities can teachers begin with to get kids speaking in their classrooms?
Mm-hmm. At the very beginning, I highly recommend, and I've said this a couple times, the use of sentence frames. And sentence frames are really helpful because students are given the grammatical, syntactical portion, right, by which to begin a response. And all they have to think about is the content then, right? And hopefully we've scaffolded the content enough that they can then fill that piece in alongside of a word wall with, right, maybe tier 2, tier 3 words, because students might be at the beginning just using tier 1 words for their responses, right? Really basic words. So I highly recommend the use of sentence frames alongside of partner talks, right? So a partner talk would be just a quick, I share, you share, we turn and face each other. So teaching all of those nonverbal cues as well, that are expectations for speaking and listening to each other. And then we graduate into the think, pair, share that I was talking about on steroids, think, pair, share 2.0, where I work with teachers to create open-ended questions that require more language, that require thoughtful language and more detail in responses. Students are then used a frame to respond to that question personally first. They then share it with a partner. That partner paraphrases what the partner just said, so that gets to the active listening portion. And then finally, they have a second conversation, a consensus conversation, to determine what they want to share with the whole class. So that's a little more sophisticated. I at first really ask teachers to think through the 15-minute rule, right? And where are you going to have stopping points? Within an hour, I may have the first two 15-minute segments, might be a partner talk, and then I'm going to end with a think, pair, share, or a group activity of some sort, right? Helping teachers to see, I think, using a clock, if you will, right? Where at 1:15, I'm going to have a partner talk. 1:30, I'm going to have a partner talk. And then I'm going to end with a larger or longer sort of collaborative experience where students come to consensus or synthesize further, right, what they just learned or read. So just really practically helping teachers disrupt the silence, right? And see how they can practically disrupt that silence.
Yeah, that's the exact adjective I was thinking. It's practical, but what you're describing, I think it's really applicable. And I think teachers will really appreciate hearing about that. And we'll definitely link to your books at when we post the blurb with this episode so that they can find those resources because they're so helpful.
Thank you.
We talk about wanting students to have a voice in the classroom. How can we create opportunities for L students to locate themselves in conversations in our schools? How can they feel safe to share their thinking?
We talk a lot during my trainings in you know my courses and in the shadowing book about creating a safe environment for classroom conversations. And I mean, during this pandemic, we're seeing the role of social emotional, right? Even more so, I hope, again, this is a lesson that we need to take back with us to the face-to-face classroom setting, right? Around creating safety, creating community, and knowing how to do that. Because we don't know what our students are experiencing, right, at home. And so I highly recommend, and we work through this when we work on the last strategy that I recommend in the shadowing book, which is reciprocal teaching. I have teachers work through norms for discussion. Mm. Norms for classroom participation. And oftentimes students can help you kind of develop these so that there is voice, so that there's choice, right? So that they feel like they were a part of it. The teacher isn't, you know, telling us what the expectations are, or mm-hmm. all of the expectations are. You may want to set up some of them. And I'm thinking through, so a teacher that I worked with in a school district in Southern California, who was a reciprocal teaching expert, if you will. He kind of took this to a whole other level. He's a high school English teacher. His name is Danny Magana. We wrote an article together, myself, Danny Magana, and I'll send you the article too if you want to post that.
Great.
And the coach, the instructional coach who really worked with this teacher. And I'm looking for so he put together some really inclusive, equitable norms, classroom norms for group work specifically, mm-hmm. but it can be used for collaboration as well. And they were, everybody in the group contributes equally, be respectful of group members and their opinions, stay focused on the task and your own group, pay attention to what other people need. It's not about you, it's about the group or the pair, if you will, right? Or the class, the whole class. No one is done until everyone is done. And I always think about, right, if I had that in my classroom setting, right? And I used group work when I taught eighth grade English, actually. We did a lot of group work. We did a lot of literature circles in particular. And that's how it starts. You have to set the stage for, right, having a respectful classroom climate for communication, right? Mm-hmm. And for taking those language or collaborative risks. And then our affective filter lowers, right? We're more likely to be engaged and motivated to speak to each other. Mm. Instead of historically what we've done is to overcorrect students and to focus on, right, when they do speak on that piece instead of how do we create a culture for classroom talk? Mm.
And this makes me think of another question I had listed there in terms of the cultural norms of speaking in school and out of school. And I appreciate that you shared those norms, those inclusive norms, because I think that a lot of times we see teachers trying to create environments where they want their students to speak. And sometimes the norms are so embedded in dominant culture that they don't make sense to RLs, and it's even more confusing. What do you think teachers need to know about culturally embedded elements of spoken discourse when they're trying to get their kids speaking?
Mm-hmm. So something, I mean, I always think of with this question, I think of eye contact, right? That most of us, the American culture, the expectation is that you're listening when you are, when you're actually looking at the person who is speaking to you, right? Mm-hmm. So just making sure that we know who's in front of us, right? And we know the culture and language are intertwined, right? So making sure that we know the cultural backgrounds of our students and what those specific expectations are, so that we're not, there isn't, implicit bias around, right, when our students are just functioning according to their cultural norms.
Right.
So I will typically contrast, I'll say American even in the classroom setting, I will say American expectations for listening in particular are typically, looking at each other maintaining eye contact, rather, looking at the person who, the speaker, sitting up, getting oxygen to the brain, perhaps note-taking can be sometimes, right? So I usually try to just acknowledge the distinctions, and then I like contrasting. So we have a couple of, what are some of the expectations there, and having students discuss that if they're at that comfort level, but also on the part of the teacher, making sure that the teacher knows who's in the room, one, right, and what those expectations are, and then contrasting that so that students do actually, because they may encounter another teacher who has very rigid, right, expectations for speaking and listening.
Right. I think it makes it, there's so much less stress if you just make it explicit and say, like, so this is typically what happens. Like, let's talk about how we want it to happen in our classroom.
Yes. So that could be a part of, right, what are going to be our listening? We can have another list of listening expectations, right? Listening and speaking expectations. Mm. And how are we going to know that that is actually happening?
Right. As we see teachers and as we ourselves start creating opportunities for L's to engage in conversational discourse, what happens? What have you seen happen, and what will happen in the long term?
Around speaking and listening specifically?
Yeah. Like if we're allowing L's to speak more, we're asking them to speak more, and we're requiring them to speak more. What happens for them? What happens in our classrooms?
We'll have a more democratic and equitable classroom setting, right? Where we're not just valuing and validating one perspective, where we are inclusive of, different points of view, multiple perspectives, right, which is a 21st century skill, right? This translates into society being able to listen to somebody who disagrees with you and not going to blows with them, right? To be able to have when we see that in politics right now, right? So just making sure that we, can have conversations that are evidence-based and where there are multiple viewpoints. I think it would solve a lot of practical issues, but then academically, we know for the rest of our lives, we are going to be, unfortunately, judged by the way that we speak, And so making sure, and that's not to say, I want to make sure that we are respecting the primary language, that we are respecting a variation of English, home language, whatever that, you know, may be, because that is, right, that's language that is survival language, that is home language, right? That is heart language. But in the academic space, what I want to make sure that my student, I want to make sure that my students know and English learners know how to code switch, right? Use the appropriate language set for the context that they're in. And we all do that all of the time, all day long, right? And so giving them that dexterity, right? That ability to be able to switch, right? And to also be able to keep their primary language so that there isn't language loss, or that variation of English so that there isn't language loss there either.
Yeah, I think sometimes people who aren't ENL teachers or ESOL teachers, whatever they're called, wherever you are, I think they're surprised when we say, oh, actually the goal of what we do is not to create English speakers, it's to create multilingual speakers. Yeah. They sometimes forget, or maybe they just didn't think about it that way before.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And what an asset, right? That these students are bringing to the table. And the ability to look at things from multiple perspectives and enrich the classroom setting.
Yes. Dr. Soto, thank you so much for answering all of my questions today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I think that the strategies that you shared will be so applicable for our listeners, and we'll link to your books, and I'll follow up with you to get the access to that article that you talked about with the inclusive norms. That'll be awesome.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guests we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please find those on our webpage. This podcast is produced by Mid-State Arburn at OCM BOCES. And our theme music is Sunbeam from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.